Blog Talk Radio.
People of Earth, welcome.
Wow, there's a new entrance.
Yeah. I just get tired of saying welcome to Movie Geeks United every show. So
I understand.
I'll mix it up
me,
a bit.
Understand.
How are you, man?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm good. Tonight is a packed show. We have a great director, great filmmaker, Mr. Stephen Frears, on with us tonight. You know him and love him for movies like Grifters, Dangerous Liaisons. Give me some others. Prick up your ears.
Prick up your ears. There's the Grifters. There's the Hit. There's with
Dirty
Sherry,
Pretty Things.
There's I think Mrs. Henderson Presents, if I'm not mistaken.
He is.
He's all over the place.
Yeah, the one thing that characterizes his career is it's hard to characterize his career because
that's
he's
great
so,
about him.
So versatile. Yeah, he's one of those guys. And also, it's interesting to know, he really hates being interviewed.
Well, I saw him speak after another great Stephen Frears movie, Dirty Pretty Things, after screaming of that. He just gave these, like, one-word answers, basically yes and no.
It's not pleasant for some people, you know, the process. And, you know, a lot of filmmakers feel like they've said everything they need to say about that particular movie in the movie. You know, that's why they went through the trouble of making it.
That's very true.
Yeah, which makes our job kind of obsolete.
It does.
Yeah. But after Mr. Frears, we have a great interview with Doug Adams, who is the author of a new book called The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films, which chronicles the 10-year journey that Howard Shore undertook to compose those themes for those three films. And he's about to go through it all over again with The Hobbit, which is now in pre-production. So that's an exciting project. All of it. Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, the book on the Lord of the Rings music, Howard Shore's work in general on it. It's all exciting. And then the New York Film Festival closed today. And to give us a second half recap of that film festival a little later on in the show, we have our New York correspondent Dean Treadway joining us. He came on a couple of weeks ago to share his thoughts on some of the earlier screenings from the festival, like Social Network and A Letter to Elia and that kind of thing. And this time he's back. He's going to talk to us about the new Mike Lee movie and a lot of other stuff that premiered the second half of that festival. So I wanted to share this, Jerry. I shared it on social media. But I said that clearly the most exciting news for me in the world of films this week is the announcement that Al Pacino is going to play Phil Spector in a biopic for HBO written and possibly directed by David Mamet, produced by Barry Levinson.
Sounds good. I saw that earlier, yeah.
I don't know why I didn't think of that, because obviously, you knew they were going to do a Spectre film. Tom Cruise has been talking about playing Spectre for a long, long time, actually, for another project I know of when this murder charge first came about. But looking at Phil Spector, I should have known, you know, Pacino would be great for this part because he's, you know, Phil Spector's obviously brilliant. But Phil Spector's also very kind of wiry and out there and kind of elevated in his personality. All traits that I think Pacino can pull off beautifully.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and they've got similar hair, too.
Okay, sure thing.
I love Pacino. I don't mean don't get the wrong idea.
No, because everyone knows on this show, if they've stayed with it this far, you worship Pacino.
Exactly. And Mamet. You know, HBO has really, if you look at these projects in Angels in America and You Don't Know Jack and now the Phil Spector, they have really done wonders for this act of Pacino's career.
Yeah, they have. You're absolutely right.
That's the place to be. And I read another, I think it was the New York Times, a very lengthy article on Michael Mann's series for HBO called Luck.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Where his two leads are Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte.
Wow.
You know? I mean, what a project.
Mm-hmm.
HBO rocks. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everyone, in the chat room. Thanks for joining us tonight, and thanks for joining us on Replay Archive, too, if that's how you're listening to the show. Let us get to our first interview with Mr. Stephen Frears. Tomorrow Drew, his new film, is currently in limited release. I'm sure it'll open wider as the weeks go on. It's a great story. It's funny. It's charming. It's very sexy. It's kind of about this at one time ugly duckling, Tamara Drew, who returns to her hometown in the countryside as a very, very powerfully sexy adult woman and throws everyone in a tiff, and she kind of turns the lives of people in this village upside down. It's very charming. It's based on a very popular comic strip in England by Posy Simmons, who really was crucial to the project. She worked closely with Mr. Frears on it. And it has a very different kind of visual style for Mr. Frears because he's following a graphic novel. He almost has a storyboard to work from as he shot this movie. So we talked to Mr. Frears about all of that. The interview is conducted by our correspondent, Aranata Diaz. Here is Stephen Frears.
How are you settling in?
It's paradise. Crap.
Did it sell?
Well, of course, my kind of books aren't about sales, so no.
His touch was like a cosmic yes.
Nadia, go to the pub and stay there. I'll come when I can.
Who are you talking to, is this?
Marriage. Remind me never to try it.
You're just a sex object, and I wanted to have you.
Sometimes I wish I could get distracted.
Hello.
Who's that? That's Tamara Drew. Good God, what's happened to her?
Had a nose job, Dad. I love your new hooter. Not actually you, it's just smaller.
She's single, you know.
What do you have to do to get a cup of tea around here?
Make it. Tea, sugar, fridge.
She's completely different.
I couldn't agree more.
He never grew up.
In his trousers.
It's your house.
Yeah. Want to buy it?
No. I want something else.
Wait.
What does she see in that little boy?
Maybe she's trying to make you jealous. Or maybe she's just a bit kinky.
Do I get my treat?
You are so cheesy.
The real secret of being a writer is learning how to lie.
Even if I was the last man in the world, Tamara Drew wouldn't hurt me.
When can we do this again? To the muse. However you find her.
I didn't know they provided material too.
But you once said that British filmmakers that aren't interested in making and telling stories about their middle class.
Yes.
As your movie does.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. We all tend to be middle class, and I suppose perhaps we find that perhaps we don't like our own class, or we're embarrassed by it, or perhaps we find the working class and the upper class is more exotic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very aware of it. I mean, it's very noticeable. The French make films about the middle classes. Perhaps the actors feel uncomfortable.
And this is based on a very popular comic strip.
Yeah.
And how did you get involved with that? How did you become aware of this property?
I was sent the script.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, I'd read the comic.
Mm-hmm.
On when it was on in the newspapers, and indeed I've known the graphic artist for 40 years.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Are you a filmmaker, or do you distinguish between, you know, when you saw this, you know, in the paper, and you saw this?
Thought he would make a film until I read a script. Mm-hmm. I just thought, what a brilliant idea, but it wasn't my idea.
And have you gotten any indication of her feelings on the finished product?
Posey, she seems very pleased with it.
Adaptation of comic strips / graphic novels are kind of the in vogue thing right now.
Yes.
Have you followed?
I've only read one graphic novel in my life.
Okay.
Which is this one. But I've begun to learn about this whole world. Mm-hmm. And when I go home, I'll try read some.
Film, you know, obviously film is a visual medium. Graphic novels are a visual medium.
Yeah.
You know, it seems that they seem to, while they're not the same visual
medium. I've come to see that what Posey Simmons does is exactly what I do.
What was your challenge? What was the biggest challenge with this script as a director?
Oh, you know, to keep the spirit up.
Mm-hmm.
To keep people, you know, keep people's spirits up. Not to let it get, you know. Mm-hmm. Always with comedy, you need it to be like a souffle, to keep the souffle up and in the air.
Well, I'm curious about this. With the, you know, the tone of this story is very delicate, from dramatic to kind of light, whimsy, and ricocheting back and forth.
Yeah.
And so that tone is very important, you know, to the success of the story. And so I'm curious, as a filmmaker, when you're in the process of shooting, when do you do you become aware in the middle of filming that it's clicking, or is it not until the editing room that it starts to come together?
No, you don't leave the floor unless it's right, really. I mean, you go on shooting a scene until you've got it right.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the cutting room you discover if your judgment was correct. But I could always tell when the scenes were where, what I thought they should be.
Was there a rehearsal process on this?
No, not really. I think the people are very, very well cast,
mm-hmm.
which means there's not a great deal to rehearse.
Are you not a big proponent of the rehearsal?
No, I prefer it to be more sort of spontaneous. I like it to come from the actors, and I like to be able to see what they're doing.
But on the same hand, you're not a 2-3 takes and out kind of filmmaker, is that correct?
I would be if I was braver. I can hear when something is right.
Right.
I really direct with my ear as much as my eye.
And one of your collaborators in this is the great composer Alexandre Desplat.
He's wonderful.
You know, Benjamin Button and many other
scores.
And what was that collaboration like?
He's a brilliant man. Mm-hmm. And he reads films in a very, very clever way. It's a joy to know him.
What has been your most surprising and most, I guess, maybe rewarding of this kind of screening the finished film for people?
Well, so far it's been very, very gratifying. You just see the pleasure it gives people. You know, when I grew up, films were both enjoyable and intelligent. And there wasn't this sort of separation that takes place.
Right.
So I suppose what I'm trying to do is to make a film that is like, you know, the films that I grew up with.
Right.
You know, when you went to see a Billy Wilder film, you didn't say, this isn't done commercially. It was just generally extremely enjoyable and clearly made by men of high intelligence.
One of the directors you worked under early on was Lindsay Anderson.
Yeah.
And what did you gain from working with, you know, those early giants of the British 60s cinema?
Well, you learn a lot about life, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were highly intelligent. You know, you learned how to think, really, and how to live. I think more than anything else, they're sort of inspiring in their lives.
You work primarily a lot of times in your home country and telling stories about the middle class, but every now and then you do turn your eye to American-based stories.
Yeah.
The Grifters and Hero in particular. And you've done this a few times. I'm curious on what is it about, I guess, you know, America, as kind of generic as that may sound, interesting?
I've grown up seeing American films, reading American books.
Yes.
It would be a miracle if I wasn't interested in American things.
Right.
I mean, I can see that when I whenever I've made a film here, I've used a sort of different bit of my brain.
And when you made, like, a movie, when you do a grifter or a hero, are you at all aware or consciously aware that, you know, particularly, in the grifters, that you're working in kind of the, you know, American film noir tradition? And
I remember I always used, in the cutting room, I used to say, is this an American film or a European film? Of course, the American film noir tradition largely came from Europeans.
And the same thing with Hero, that was obviously in the Frank Capra screwball tradition.
Yes, that's right.
And was it fun kind of working in that kind of, working within the mechanics of that kind of storytelling?
Yes, and I could see that the films were largely influenced by the American cinema. Yes, absolutely.
Your last big hit here from 3 years ago was the Queen.
Yes.
Was spectacular, and Helen Mirren got an Oscar.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about, you know, because that film is very smart, and obviously because of you and screenwriter Peter Morgan, about the British, present-day British monarch system.
Yeah.
Kind of it's clashing with kind of 21st century media culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious of if there have been any new developments in that kind of clash since you've made that film.
You know, it was the only time in my life that the Queen was really criticized.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, that's a sort of tribute to her, I suppose. I don't think there'll be a revolution in my lifetime.
Are you wary of that, or are you kind of hoping that never happens?
Well, most of my life has been spent wanting change, but I don't think there will be any change. You know, it's quite odd being a subject and not a citizen.
Okay. What are you working on now?
I may make a film in Las Vegas in the spring.
Oh, really?
Hmm. Wow. About a sports foot gambler.
Have you been to Vegas before?
I was there 3 weeks ago.
And what do you think of that obviously very kind of American city?
Well, normally, the only times I've been before, I've gone as a sort of tourist.
Right.
And this time, I had a sort of inside pass because I was with people who live there and work there. And it was, I found it very, very interesting.
Before I let you go, I got to ask about one of my all-time favorite films of the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's Prick Up Your Ears.
Yep.
And I'm just curious, any kind of, you know, it's almost coming up on 25 years of that film.
Good God, yes, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, now, you know, everyone kind of takes Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina as a given. Everyone now knows him. And I'm convinced there's still a ton of people who don't even know this film.
Yes.
And hopefully if they hear this, they'll go out and rent it.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, what do you remember most, looking back at that film, what do you remember most of that experience of working with those two actors, you know, before
they became... Well, they were both very, very good.
Yeah.
Gary looked like Joe Orton. Fred looked less like Halliwell. But,
right.
But they were both wonderful. And I'm not surprised that both of them... I mean, they were really good. You know, I was just lucky. I was the person who took them into a film that they were going to be successful. They were very highly regarded as young actors.
That story of those two guys and their kind of doomed relationship really has a potency and resonance.
Yes, I'm
probably asking, even more now than maybe some of them thought of then. Would you?
Yeah, well, I remember the real relationship. I remember the killing and the bodies being found.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it resonates now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the world has got much better.
Who's that? That's Tomorrow Drew. No, it isn't. I met her with Andy. God, what's happened to her?
She's had a nose job, Dad.
She's completely different. That's what Andy said.
Poor Tamara. She's such a sad girl. She's come to help you wash the car, didn't she, Nicholas?
No, it was
teenage. She liked a bit of family after her dad left. Tamara Drew that writes a column on the Sundays. Used to. Writes The Independent now.
Oh, yeah. She spent weeks going on about her nose job. Was her old one an awful conk?
Yes.
Pulled herself into those shorts. They don't give her thrush.
Okay, that is Stephen Frears. His new movie, Tamara Drew, is now open in select theaters, I believe in New York and L.A., and it will be available soon in expanded markets.
Cool. That was a very interesting interview. Fascinating. And that's kind of how we know Stephen Frears. That's definitely...
Yeah. And we'll be debuting Alexander Splatt's score for Tamara Drew at the end of tonight's show. Speaking of scores, I scored this weekend. No, I'm kidding. speaking of film scores, Wednesday night is our Name That Film Score show. Three opponents going up against each other to name that film score. It's a lot of fun. And this is probably the last time this year that we'll be doing it. So check it out. And also, one of the contestants on the show, Austin Wintory, he heads up a charity organization called Education Through Music LA in Los Angeles.
Right.
ETMLA.com is where you can look up the website. And their big charity event is next weekend. So they're going to come on Wednesday night and talk a little bit more about it. But you can give to the cause yourself, and it's a very worthy cause, by going to their website. There's an online auction taking place right now to raise funds for this organization. And they're giving away great you bid for it. prizes. That you can only get there. Stuff like Michael Giacchino will compose an original ringtone for your cell phone. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be awesome.
And a lot of people in the motion picture industry are behind this cause, so you're going to get a lot of very unique items from that website. So go to etmla.com and read more about it. Also, we're giving away stuff. Here
we are. This
on
is
the
very
show.
Big stuff we're giving away. Well, at least I think it is.
I think so too. One of the things we're giving away, the Goonies is celebrating its 25th anniversary with a big Ultimate Collector's Edition box set. It's worth $50. It's from Warner Brothers. And it's got lots of great stuff in it. It's got a board game in it. It's got collectible prints in it. It's got a 1985 souvenir magazine with a bunch of behind-the-scenes stories. It's got a big article with the cast and Steven Spielberg and Richard Donner and commentaries and documentaries, deleted scenes. You even get Cyndi Lauper's music video.
Awesome.
The Goonies are good enough in this box set. It's a terrific package. We're going to give you three chances to win one of these box sets. We have three to give away. Starting on Wednesday night's show, we're going to ask a trivia question related to the Goonies on Wednesday the 13th, Wednesday the 20th, and Sunday the 24th.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Sounds good.
We're going to ask a trivia question about the Goonies. Now, if you hear these trivia questions, if you know the answer to any of them, you can email that answer to moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. by Saturday the 30th, and you could win this box set. We will announce on our live show on the 31st, Halloween night, where we cover DVDs on that show, we'll announce the winners. So make sure you do that. And the Goonies is available Tuesday, November 2nd, for everyone that wants to actually go and buy it, doesn't want to participate in the giveaway. Also, we're giving away, to give you a 180 here, we're giving away three copies of The Human Centipede on DVD. Now, I'm sure you guys out there have heard of this movie. It's as disgusting and as disturbing as it gets, apparently. So you can win a copy of the DVD from us. You don't have to answer a trivia question, but we would like a story from you. If you email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, tell us about the movie that disturbed you the most. Just tell us what it is and how it disturbed you. You could win one of the copies of this film, and we will announce the winner also on that show on the 31st.
Okay.
So two giveaways. Exciting stuff.
I think, should I enter this contest for The Human Centipede?
Yeah, if you got, we got a couple of stories in here.
I bet you do.
So far for the Human Centipede.
Ty Pearson, Human Centipede is wonderful.
We got one story about Patton Oswalt, and that came in. So
okay, cool.
So we'll reveal the stories too.
Okay.
Sunday show. Okay, let's. We're going to bring on Dean at the top of the hour to give us a recap of the New York Film Festival. So let's get right into the second interview. The Lord of the Rings is obviously a phenomenon, but what's really delightful and surprising is how much the score has caught on too. I mean, the symphony orchestras from around the world play this in concert. I think they had a gig recently at Radio City Music Hall. And this book covers the whole process of putting this score together. Howard Shore is the composer, obviously. Doug Adams is a big Howard Shore aficionado, and he traveled with Howard Shore throughout this entire 10-year process of scoring these three films. Yeah, and so we had a conversation with him about the book and his observations on Mr. Shore. Here it is. Enjoy it. Before we get into the book, tell me a little bit about you and where your love of music began, and particularly film music.
It began, like a lot of these things, completely by accident. When I was a really little kid, my dad went out to get me the LP of The Story of The Empire Strikes Back, and accidentally came back with the LP of John Williams' score. And, you know, I was really little at this point, but I listened to it. You know, I didn't think I'd even realized at first they'd bought the wrong thing, and I went all the way through it, and all four sides of the LPs, and Dad finally realized he got the wrong one and went to take it back, and I said, no, I'm keeping this thing. I like it. And, you know, it just kind of steamrolled from there, you know. I studied piano as a kid and played music through the school music programs, and then went on to study music in college for a bachelor's and a master's degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's my, it's always been a friend there for me all the time, so it's been a pretty cool experience.
Well, as somebody that's studied music extensively and a musician yourself, what is unique to you about music for film?
Music for film is always fascinating to me because it sort of exists outside of a specific historical context. In other words, you can have, you know, cutting-edge serialism next to electronics, next to jazz, next to Gregorian chant from centuries ago. Mm-hmm. You know, this sort of polyglot approach to it all that... And it's funny, I think in some ways it's actually influenced what happens in the modern concert music world, this idea of compiling history, and rather than throwing things out, you know, it's evolution rather than revolution now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that came out of the film world, you know, that wasn't something, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, composers were ready to throw out the entire harmonic vocabulary and then start over. And now people have found a way to say, we can keep the things that were important to us in past centuries and build on them and combine them in new ways. And I'm not just talking about, you know, sort of, you know, ironic postmodern quotes of things. There's a way to enliven this music. And film really led the way for that. You know, we live in a world where you can have film scores that are, you know, incredibly ancient sounding and, you know, have a very specific relation to Renaissance music and things like that. Or you get up to music like Goldsmith's Planet of the Apes, which is an entirely serial composition featuring all this wild percussion and steel mixing bowls and, you know, fantastic ideas like that. And it all sort of fits under this umbrella. It's just a cool, flexible genre that allows composers to really stretch their imaginations in a way that maybe they're not always allowed to in the concert world, which would seem backwards. It seems like film should be more restrictive, but it's really not, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the idea that, and this is true of all music, popular music, when we hear a certain song, it might take us back to a particular moment in our lives. But with film music, it obviously is so tied in with the experience of the film, especially one as beloved as Lord of the Rings. Is it also important that the music stand on its own outside of the experience of the film?
Well, look, there's an old saying in film music that the job of a film composer is to write the best music for this project. You know, they write music that's essentially subservient to a visual presentation. And I would argue that that's not really true. The job of a film composer is to write the best music he can that serves this particular project. I think that if a film composer is doing his job correctly, he should be creating good music. You know, it's sort of like you don't go to a costume designer and say, you know, make something that only works for this scene. You have to make something substantial that works for this scene. You know, whatever the substance of that particular costume happens to be, or a set designer, or any of these people that work on, you know, film, which is essentially a collaborative process. But you still have to have that quality in and of yourself before you combine with the other elements. You know, I'm sure we've all seen films where it's beautifully shot, the performances are amazing, and someone comes in with this very tripe music that just kind of squeaks and squawks away in the background. It isn't really obtrusive, but it's very poor music.
Right.
And that's that's somebody dropping the ball. You know, you don't like to see that happen. That's not what film music should aspire to be. It should aspire to be fine music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, existing away from the film, that's a different thing, of course, because there's certainly taste and subjectivity involved there, but it should be a solid musical composition first and foremost. You know, that has to be what it is that comes into the collaboration, in my opinion, anyway. I mean, that's just as subjective as anything else. But
oh, no, I'm with you on that. I agree with you completely. You know, we had Howard Shore on the show a couple of years ago, and we spent the majority of the time talking about Lord of the Rings, and it's such a jaw-dropping, astounding accomplishment, the breadth and the scope of this project. Excuse me. While he was in the middle of recording, correct me if I'm wrong, he called you to spend time with him?
It was actually even a little bit earlier than that. It was right when he was gearing up for Fellowship, really. He had done some early composition work on Fellowship. They had just finished the Cannes presentation for the 2001 Film Festival, where they presented the Mind of Moria sequence. And I think it was like May of 2001 when I spoke to him. And he was working on a film for Frank Oz. Right? He was doing the score, which is that picture with De Niro and Marlon Brando and Ed Norton. And I was writing for a magazine, Film Score Monthly, and covered film and television music. And I'd up until that point, sort of been the go-to guy for Howard Shore interviews. He and I had always gotten along very, very well. We would do the interview and then sit and chat for an extra hour past the end of the interview because we had a lot of similar interests in the arts. You know, we liked a lot of the same things, and we kind of tested each other's knowledge about this film or this opera, or, you know, having a good time speaking about things that we both enjoyed. And it was funny, too, because I was in grad school at the time, living, you know, in my parents' house in my old bedroom where I grew up, so he'd call and get my parents on the phone sometimes. It was a very strange collision of professional and personal lives. Anyway, so I was speaking to him about the score, the Frank Oz picture, and at the end of the interview, we went to our mode when we would sit and chat about this or that, and he said, you know, I'm just signed up to do The Lord of the Rings. We're working on that right now. And of course, I knew, but you don't want to blurt that out and look like you have no self-control, so I tried to play it cool. I said, I know. I didn't want to say anything, but that's fantastic. Congratulations. And he said, you know, this looks like this could be a bit larger than the usual project. Would you have any interest in sticking around and following it? Maybe we could do something together. So, you know, I don't think he had the sentence out of his mouth before I was blurting out, yes, I'll do it.
And man, in 10 years later, or nearly 10 years later, I mean, this was an epic undertaking, not only for him, but certainly for you. Did you know kind of what you were getting into here?
No, I have no idea. I'd hear about, like, Peter Jackson or Fran Walsh or Google Boyant. They'd say, you know, we spent 8 years in Middle Earth working on these things and then bringing these to life. And I used to think, how could anybody spend that long dedicated to one project? That's crazy. Now I kind of,
well,
these guys are
lightweight. I put
in 9 years.
Yeah. So having kind of intimate knowledge of Mr. Shore's work prior to starting this project, how would you characterize his unique voice as a composer, and what made him an ideal choice for Lord of the Rings?
Well, it was funny. I mean, he was always a secret weapon composer. You know, those of us that loved his music knew him from the Cronenberg pictures. We knew him
right.
from these small, thoughtful boutique pictures, Naked Lunch and The Fly and these Scanners and amazing things like this. And when he was announced for The Lord of the Rings, even I, who was an enormous fan of his work, raised my eyebrows a little bit. Really, Howard's going to take this one on? Well, that's really different. That's fantastic. You know, there were names floating around at the time. We thought Basil Poledouris would get it. We thought James Horner would get it. Because they were sort of known for this big epic sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's exactly why Howard was the right guy for the job and why it was such an amazing choice on the part of the filmmakers. Because Howard had always created these scores that were about emotion and character. And the idea of translating the written word to another expressive format. You know, he'd done Looking for Richard, which dealt with Shakespearean text. Naked Lunch, of course, is a famous example of a book everyone said could never be transformed into a film, and they pulled it off. And you took this level of intelligence and care and thoughtfulness and coupled it with, you know, now an epic palette. And I think that's why it became such an incredible combination. I mean, even if you watch the films, there's elements of that in the filmmaking, you know. Peter Jackson, even in the most, you know, enormous battle scenes or the crack of doom, things like that, he always brings it down to the struggle of the individual. You know, you'll go to a close-up, you'll see someone's face full screen, you'll see emotion on their face. You know, it comes from these wide vistas to these close-ups. And that's really how Howard approached this, is that it wasn't simply about scale and scope and spectacle. It was about the relationship of these characters in this world. You know, when you get to Mount Doom, it's not just this big, brooming, fiery explosion. It's these two characters that have struggled for 11 hours to get there.
And it
puts so much heart into these stories. And I think that's a big reason why these scores have touched so many people in such a profound way, really. I mean, it's been remarkable. I've over the last couple of almost 10 years now, as we've been working on this book, I've done a lot of traveling with live performances and lectures and things like that. So I've been all over the world. And it's remarkable. Every place you go, they think they're the hobbits. You know, you go to Switzerland, everyone says, oh, the characters from the Shire, they're the ones that really understand us. You know, this is written so much about our way of life. People from Poland felt that way. People from England, people from all parts of the U.S. It's such a universal story.
Yeah,
and Howard kept that in the music. You know, he could have been blown off the screen by just big screeching music that did nothing other than impress, you know, look at this music budget. I can have four times people in the choir. Okay, great. But, you know, he kept it, he kept the humanity in it, and that's such a unique thing in that type of filmmaking.
I think you articulated it beautifully. It, just like the film, his music, It does not sacrifice the intimate for the epic, and
right.
I think that is a big temptation when you're dealing with these massive films. What were you particularly struck by observing his working process?
I was struck by how the heck am I sitting here watching Howard Shore write music? it was pretty remarkable. It's been I hit a point in the production where I had to take all these people's autographs off of my wall because they're all my heroes to begin with, and I was like, well, I'm working with them. I guess I have to take this autograph down. I suppose what really struck me from a creative standpoint the most was he was able to keep one eye constantly on the overall arc of this story,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, it's essentially 11 hours of filmmaking. If you really get into the extended editions and, you know, there's music all throughout them. And it wasn't simply a collection of musical moments to him. You know, this is a fight, this is a love scene, this is a chase, this is sad, this is whatever. He always had a concept of how they fit into the bigger piece. And I think so much of that was just instinct. Because, you know, he didn't know exactly where he was going with it always, the same way as Tolkien didn't. You know, he wrote from one day to the next and kind of saw what came out and reacted to that when he went back to the writing table.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard did it the same way. But, again, when you're dealing with a composer that has that, you know, well, incredibly refined sense of aesthetics, you just, you know, it's natural to him. He's going to make something that's in balance with itself. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And that's,
yeah.
You know, that's a big deal in modern, you know, spectacle or action filmmaking. Sometimes it's like the whole thing is turned up to 11. You know, from start to finish, it's just screaming
mm-hmm.
at you, and there's really no sense of build or architecture or a, you know, a beautiful shape to it.
Yeah.
But Howard did that, you know, dealing with essentially one of the largest stories ever put on film in this style. So,
when you're writing the book, was it a challenge to make it kind of digestible for the non-musicians, the ones that don't necessarily understand that language?
Yes, and that was very important to me because, again, it goes back to that idea of everybody relating to this story. It would feel very disingenuous to write a book that only appeals to 0.5% of those people. So we kind of came upon the idea that, you know, if you're writing about music, you want to write about music. You don't want to have to be apologetic about that and sort of, you know, fudge your way around musical thinking. But at the same time, you do have some leeway in your vocabulary. So what we came up with was the idea of approaching this as essentially a narrative analysis. You know, we're retelling the story in analytical terms, but we try to keep all that emotion and heart in there at the same time. So everything is framed in terms of the narrative, in terms of the story and the characters, the events. You know, for example, everybody knows the theme that opens the pictures, which is associated with the history of the ring. The da 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 da.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you take that collection of pitches, there's four different pitches in that, and some of them are repeated, so it's more than a four-note phrase, but there's four different pitches in there. If you play those four pitches simultaneously, you have the chord that you always hear when the ring rates appear on screen. Well, obviously the connection there is that both of these are elements of a past age of Middle Earth, and the ring's history is also the wraith's history because they've been chasing it for years and years and years. Now, what I've told you there is usually the type of idea that, you know, graduate students in music get into, and they love to sit around coffee houses and talk about it. And I know that because I was one of them. But if you put it in terms of the story, well, it makes perfect sense to anyone that hears that. And it makes sense, you know, from a storytelling standpoint. Of course Howard would do something like that. It makes logical sense. It's great.
Wow.
It also enhances what you're hearing because you're starting to realize that this music is not just stringing together moods. It's also telling the story in its own terms. You know, every element of this story, from history, culture, to geography, is in Howard's music. And it just brings a whole extra level of appreciation to the emotion that we all sort of lock into immediately. And I just think that's such a cool thing, you know, because you can see a composition through its composer's eyes. I mean, it's a very pure, wonderful thing that, you know, it's just remarkable to me.
It is. It is one of the great, remarkable achievements in film music. And the book is just... It's a must own. It's so beautifully done. Give me a sense of what our listeners who are going to purchase the book, what they can discover within the pages.
Well, we begin and end sort of with the production of the scores. You know, the opening chapters are Howard coming onto this project and the filmmaker's early ideas and his early ideas and his first trips down to New Zealand, all that sort of stuff. And really how he set pencil to paper for the first time, starting to come up with themes for characters. What was his first conception of the piece? And then the end of the book is sort of returning to that by way of the recording sessions. You meet up with Howard at these sessions in England and see how he interacts with the filmmakers and learn about some of the venues they recorded in, the musicians that performed, some of the unique instruments that are in there. And then in the middle of the book, essentially the heart of the book, is really looking at the music. We start with all the themes, and this incredible network of 80 or 90 different themes that he created. You know, some of them are long, sweeping themes. Some of them are little short musical statements, you know, little leitmotifs. But he used all these themes to recreate Middle Earth, and then essentially mm-hmm. set them all into motion and set them all into the story. And that's the what we call the annotated score in the central part of the book, which takes you through the story with all these musical characters we've established and show you how they come together to relate Tolkien's narrative.
Mm.
And at the same time, you know, we try to, you don't want this to come across as something very dry and analytical. So we try to write it with a language that was very much an homage to Tolkien's writing style, you know, plenty of heavy 25-cent words and hyphens, and, you know, the type of thing that he liked. And we also, and this is something we realized sort of at the 11th hour, is that the book needed to be physically lovely in its own way. You know, The Lord mm-hmm. of the Rings is such a visual thing. Even the way that Tolkien wrote, you know, there's such detail work into the writing. And the filmmaking is the same way. You know, it even really went beyond just simple filming. They used to write in the elvish armor. They would carve a little elvish prayer inside the armor, just over the heart of the actor. Now, of course, you'll never see that, but it was in there because that was the level of completion that they sought.
Hmm.
And we wanted to have the book have that same sense of thoroughness to it, same sense of visual beauty, if we could pull it off.
Yeah.
So we actually found this wonderful book designer named Gary Day Allison. And he was in England. He had actually worked with Alan Lee creating some of his sketchbooks, you know, collections of some of the work that he did for the films. So Gary came in and started working with us with all this wonderful imagery that New Line had provided, all these film stills, the beautiful musical examples, which we always had to laugh because Gary, like a lot of the readers, didn't read the music. He knew that it was visually lovely, but he didn't know what it said. So he could always refer to it as the tadpoles. He didn't, you know, I'm going to pull it on page 5. Is that okay? But Gary also brought us into touch with Alan Lee and John Howe, who were, of course, the two conceptual designers on the film. And they both had these incredible collections of all the sketchwork they had done when they were designing these pictures. And a lot of this had never been seen before because it just was on their hard drives and in their, you know, back room somewhere. And we spoke with them, and they said, well, you could just have whatever you want. You know, go ahead and put this stuff in the book. We trust, you know, Gary's doing a wonderful job. He's a brilliant guy. They were thrilled to be able to have their images next to Howard's music, so they just sort of said, here's the key, get what you want.
Wow.
And which is amazing, because, you know, they're down there in New Zealand right now working on The Hobbit. So I felt guilty every single email I would carbon them on, and I was like, I'm interrupting The Hobbit right now. This is really make myself unpopular at some point. When we came to the book's cover, you know, we tried sketch after sketch after sketch, just trying to get the right energy for the cover. And we always had Alan Lee carbon copied on the emails because we're dealing with his work, and it seems appropriate that he should at least know what's going on, even if we're sort of in the corner of his eye. And after about, you know, I don't know how many different sketches we tried, 20, 30, 40, whatever it was, we got a little note from Alan that said, I will draw you a new cover. You'll have it in 2 days. You know, just showed up in the inbox, and here you go. I hope it's okay with you. Let me know if you need any changes. And we are all kind of sat there with our jaws dropping open. We just got a new Alan Lee cover for this book. mostly because you got tired of seeing our carbon copy emails.
Well, it is so beautifully written and illustrated. I mean, it is a gorgeous volume, this book. And there's a rarity CD included as well. It's hard to believe, but there's still unreleased Lord of the Rings music out there, and it's part of this collection.
That was the very last bit of my research process. You know, Howard and I had watched the films and gone through the scores and met the players and met the filmmakers. And he sort of got to all that, and he said, you know, really what you should do if you have time and interest is you should sit and just go through every take from the recording sessions for all three films. And, you know, that's no small task. There was, you know, this was like the largest storage of music that they ever had kept at Abbey Road. You know, it was just terabytes upon terabytes, and it was huge. And I think it ended up being over a month straight of continuous audio. So I sort of set myself down to the task, and over the course of a year and a half, Howard's out in New York, I'm based in Chicago, so I would hop on planes and come spend a couple more days, and Howard gave me the keys to the listening room and showed me which storage facility held all the recordings, and just started carting things to the listening room day after day after day for the course of a year and a half. And, you know, I left myself little post-it notes all over the place. This recording has an extra couple of minutes in it. This composition was never heard. Here's an early version of this theme. Here's a song that wasn't used. And I finally got to the end, and the end of the Return of the King sessions, you can hear the champagne corks popping and everybody celebrating, and it goes to blank. So I came back and sat down and looked at, you know, this huge list that I'd made for myself and started to think, all right, what are the real gems in here? And we grabbed this, grabbed that, and it turned out that we could essentially get everything that I had found that was of, you know, unique value, and it fit right onto a CD. It was, you know, we were kind of thrilled that it worked out so well. And, you know, we didn't want to repeat things because we didn't want to put music out there that people had already paid for. It seemed a little bit, you know, abusive to say, hey, you bought this once, now you can buy it again, and you'll get two other tracks. So we tried to take the high road with all that and really put, you know, pieces that people just hadn't had any access to before.
Yeah.
And, you know, we looked at all that and then once again stepped back and said, okay, now we've got this wonderful collection, this wonderful archive of music. How do we create sort of a nice album presentation to it? How do we give it a shape that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you can, even though it's a collection of disparate materials, you can listen straight through it and feel like you've had, you know, a journey with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent a lot of time figuring out, you know, how to arrange things appropriately and finally came up with something we were pleased with, and that's now what we're calling the Lord of the Rings, the Rarities Archive.
Well, this is, I mean, I'm so impressed by this creation of yours, this wonderful book, and we're going to push it hard on the show. If our listeners want to find out where you are for signings and get additional information, your blog is at musicoflotr for Lord of the Rings .com, correct? Will you be involved in will you be doing something similar to this with The Hobbit? I mean, do you have another 10-year journey coming up ahead of you?
Yeah, Howard and I we've been running all over the place. We were just talking about this in London last week, is that, you know, The Hobbit looks like it's going to get rolling pretty quickly here. Everything seems like it's finally falling into place. And if that's the case, yeah, that's something we'd like to pursue. I think we would like to do this again. Happily, this time, most of the people on the production sort of know who I am, so I can get my access a little bit more quickly, and we won't have to maybe wait another decade to finish off the book. You know, these Lord of the Rings things always seem like they take a long time. It's just a lot of twists and turns. You know, the films were originally supposed to be like these little, just a two-picture project, and it was going to be a lower budget, and that switched at the 11th hour when it seemed like everything was falling apart, and, you know, the CDs took a long time to assemble, and the book took a long time to assemble, and The Hobbit certainly has had its share of challenges getting off the ground, so, you know, the road goes ever on. What can we do about it? ¶¶
Okay, that was Doug Adams, the author of a new book called The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films. That book is available now. You can purchase it here from our website as well. Click on the icon. It'll take you to somewhere like Amazon, Amazon, where you can purchase it.
Yeah.
You can also purchase it on our other website, our main website, moviegeeksunited.net, where you can also purchase all of our Spotlight DVDs and film books and film soundtracks from the month of October.
Everything we've ever done on the show.
Yeah, and you can download everything, all the shows that we've done, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I guess I should say this before we bring on Dean. I alluded to it in the chat room. I've seen The Walking Dead, the new series by Frank Darabont and Galen Hurd, who we're going to talk to later on in the month. The Walking Dead is the new TV series on AMC, and it's based on the best, you know, the beloved graphic novel of the same name.
Right.
It's about zombies. And there's something delirious. You can tell that Frank Darabont's kind of deliriously giddy dealing with subject matter like this, like
right.
he was on the Mist, you know. So I've seen the first two episodes. It's really very good. It's very accomplished. It's really exciting and well shot and very gory. I mean, surprisingly gory for television. But appropriately so, because that's how you want your zombie shows to be. the drawback, I think it's hard to tell from two episodes, in that, you know, it's so similar to, from what I've seen so far, to all the other kind of zombie movies. So,
okay.
Which is a genre that has really been done over time and time again. So I'm hoping that the long form of a television series allows it to build and develop in a way that's unique to it.
Okay.
Judging from the first two episodes, we haven't gotten there yet,
okay.
or at least for me. But it's really well done, well performed. The makeup, you know, something else, when they're doing like blood spurts and things like that now in movies, they do it digitally. I mean, we saw that from the Stallone films, like the Rambo and the Expendables. They do
right.
digital blood spurts when someone gets shot or sliced. Or that bothers me. I wish they'd go back to practical.
No, I know what you're saying.
You are aware that it's done digitally.
Right. You brought up The Walking Dead, but I wanted to go completely off topic here. You brought up a good point also about Boardwalk Empire, though.
Yeah.
It hasn't been as good as the first episode.
I don't think so. It's still great. I mean,
yeah,
I still sit and look at it.
That first one.
I still look and sit at it, and I'm in awe of the look of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is that just a question of Scorsese's presence as director in that first episode?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think you're right. It's hard to top that. You know, it's really hard to top that.
Yeah, it's. I'm still loyal to it. I mean,
I'll watch every episode this season and next. No doubt about it.
So you'll be hearing more about The Walking Dead in the weeks ahead, when we bring you Galen Hurd and possibly some others from the series to talk about it during the last week leading up to Halloween, our horror series, which is starting to shape up now, where we talk about new horror films and focus on classic horror films with detailed analysis, that kind of thing. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then our Kubrick series coming up that, you know, is going to be a ride to put it together. I told you, Jerry, I think the process of putting the Kubrick series together will be like Kubrick's process of making a film. It's going to take forever.
Right. I mean, just from what we've gone through so far, yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I'll reveal on the show what we've gone through. After we put the series together. I'll reveal the process of putting this series together. We've had some firsts in trying to do this thing. Okay, let's bring on Dean Treadway. He is our New York Film Festival correspondent. He joined us a couple of weeks ago to tell us about the first half of the festival. Now he's back to tell us about the second and final half. Let me bring up your line, Dean. You're on. Hey.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
What's up?
Hey, Jerry, what's up? Yeah. No, nothing much. Just enjoying the great weather.
Yeah.
Really
what
great.
What is it like there?
Very nice.
What is it like there in New York?
It's like absolutely perfect. It's the definition of absolutely perfect weather.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, New York feels like L.A.
It does. It actually does feel like down here, too. I mean, it does feel like a beautiful L.A. day here.
It's beautiful here, too, in Podunk, Florida. So yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Well,
okay, enough about the weather. What are we, like 80 years old?
Yeah, I know.
Next thing you know, we're going to start talking about how you drove here, like what interstate you took.
Okay.
Okay, let's get to one of the big ones that I wanted to know about, Dean, from this your experience in the final half of the festival, which is the new documentary from Charles Ferguson, Inside Job. Now, you've seen Capitalism, A Love Story, Michael Moore's film, I'm sure, right?
Yes, of course.
First of all, tell me how this compares and builds upon what we saw in that film.
Well, of course, you know, Michael Moore's movies are largely essays on film. This Charles Ferguson's movie doesn't approach being an essay. It becomes more of a a final dissertation on the subject matter. Just like with his previous film, what was the Iraq film?
Fahrenheit.
No, it was
No End in Sight.
No End in Sight. Just like with No End in Sight, he basically takes all of the elements and reduces them down into a manageable narrative. And you know, that's a lot of elements in both of those stories to do so with. I learned through his interview after the movie that here we got a thing.
Speaking of Michael Moore, are you in a scene from Sicko right now?
Yeah.
Or really Bringing Out the Dead. With No End in Sight. I found out through the interview at the end of the movie that he used to be Charles Ferguson, the director, was originally a mathematician, and then everything sort of clicked into place for me in terms of understanding how he does his movies, because he does put them together like an equation. You know, he is trying to find the answer to the equation.
Yeah.
And so with Inside Job, which, by the way, is also most documentaries don't need to be seen on the big screen, in my opinion. They actually improve on television with the intimacy of television somehow.
Yeah.
But with this film was one of the only documentaries that I can name that wasn't like a nature documentary or whatever that is shot in widescreen. So it's shot in 2.35. So it gives it a really huge kind of feel. It's kind of strange to say, but it starts off talking about the Icelandic economy and how it crumbled after one of its it used to have the greatest economy, one of the greatest economies in the world, and it crumbled for similar reasons than what happened here in America. So the movie actually begins with widescreen shots of Iceland, and it's quite beautiful. Also, the movie doesn't have that kind of humorous snarkiness really that comes with a Michael Moore movie. So so you don't have that. A preponderance of animated sequences and stuff like that, or whatever.
The reason why I ask about the Michael Moore movie is the two things that worried me about Inside Job. But the director Ferguson, he's amazing, so I don't doubt that it's in there. One is it digestible? Is the information understandable? Is it articulated in a way that you can follow?
Yes, it is, but it's still a huge jumble of bribery and laundering and book cooking and tax evasion, mortgage frauds, and derivative values and all that kind of stuff. So it's still a big morass of all of that stuff, but you can see where it all comes from. And luckily, he also delves into the mindset of the people who are doing this. So he delves into what would make them do this. Kind of thing, and And really what you come down to is it's a result of having a lifestyle in which they were in kind of a bubble, you know. They had no idea what anything that they were doing was affecting anybody's lives, really. So they treated it sort of like a large casino, you know, and they never even realized, you know.
But there's even a scene in the trailer where one of the, I don't know who they're talking to, one of the investors or whatever it is, attempts to articulate what you're saying. And you can hear Ferguson off camera challenging him. Are there moments when they are challenging these interview subjects or confronting them?
Oh, for sure. There's a lot of that. Charles Ferguson is, though he doesn't appear on screen, he's obviously a character in the movie in the sense that we are hearing what he has to say from behind the camera, and he is incredulous, as we all are. You know, it's of course a movie that's going to make you quite angry.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, of course.
But it's stuff
but
it's stuff you got to know, right? So, but
yeah.
He's as incredulous as we are about a lot of it. He does call these people out, and he definitely shrinks a couple of people into little bitty, you know, they just shrink under his questioning. And,
good, that's what I want to hear.
A few people don't look so great, including some of the people you really want to get it. But then there's those other people who are also just so blatant about, oh, I didn't see anything wrong about it at all. You know, they're just like, oh, I didn't see anything wrong about, you know, selling bad loans to other people and profiting on it. All, you know, they're just, you know. After a while, it actually becomes funny in and of itself. You know, it's just like, oh my God, these people are so bald faced in their cluelessness that it's just it does become funny. You know, it's a great movie. You know, no question about it. It's something that has to be seen. You know?
Okay,
never been front runner for the documentary this year.
Yeah, I think so too. I hope so.
Yeah.
A little bit later, just in a few minutes, we'll be talking about Clint Eastwood's new movie Hereafter, as well, and Dean's thoughts on that. But first, what else we got? Give me another film that you saw that you want to discuss.
Well, there's we should talk a little bit about Meek's Cutoff, the movie by Kelly Reichardt that's actually got a.
And she did Wendy and Lucy, correct?
Yeah, she did Wendy and Lucy and Old Joy.
Those are both good, yeah.
Yeah, those are great movies and quite emotional movies. Very slow paced in most ways, but just very emotional films. This has distribution, I think, in early 2011 from Oscilloscope film.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It's shot in 1:3:3, which is an old ratio, like for old movies. So once you see the screen, at least for me, it felt like I was going to be watching, you know, something from the 30s or whatever. The film takes place in the West in the late 1800s, and it basically follows three sets of wagons that are making their way towards I think Oregon, and they're trying to find a place in Oregon, and they've got a guy played by Bruce Greenwood, who has this really long shaggy beard and long shaggy hair, sort of looks like Buffalo Bill, kind of with a jacket with fringe on it and everything. He's a very colorful character. And he's the guide, and we can't tell if he's really they talk about early in the movie. Is this guide? The guide has kind of like taken them in the wrong direction, and the guide's name is Meek. He's the title character. Meek has taken them in the wrong direction, and they can't figure out if the people who are following him can't figure out if he's done it because he's incompetent or if he's done it because he's been hired by other people who don't want immigrants to come out west. So he's been hired to get them in the middle of the wilderness and lose them. That's the rumor going around, you know. And Michelle Williams and Will Patton, who's also in the movie, are discussing it very very hushly at the beginning of the film. The movie is very, very slow-paced, even more so than the other two her two previous movies. And when I first got out of the film, I was left rather cold by it because I didn't really feel it had an emotional center. I thought that it had an intellectual center because it actually becomes about the strength of the three women who are on the campaign what they do to keep everybody from losing their minds and everything, you know. So it does have an intellectual center, but it didn't have an emotional center to me like Wendy and Lucy and Oldjoy did. They're all three are about journeys of self-discovery in a lot of ways, but I didn't really feel any kind of love in the movie. It feels like at the beginning of Meek's Cut Off that everybody is kind of a walking corpse anyway. So
yeah. Oh wow.
So
well, what her films do though, they really establish a sense of the character's life and a sense of place, a sense of their place in the world. Does this movie do that well?
Well, it does, particularly when it comes to, again, with the women. See, the women are the ones that, particularly Michelle Williams, who's very good in it, she becomes the character that first breaks with Meek, who's incredibly colorful and gets along with the kids and the men think that he's worth listening to or whatever, but the women start to doubt him, particularly Michelle Williams, and it's her strength that kind of propels the movie along to where it eventually gets to. There's an Indian guy that appears in the middle of the film, and that becomes another bit of dramatic tension that's introduced. I ended up, you know, after I thought about it for a little while, I ended up liking the movie a little bit better than I did when I first got out of the film because it started me thinking on which side of the argument is Meek evil or is he just stupid?
And yeah.
Sometimes
people are both, like our last president.
Exactly. So it's like.
Okay.
So
don't know.
So you know, I liked it
okay.
a little bit, but I didn't love it like I did the other two movies.
Yeah, that movie's going to be a hard sell. I mean, you could tell just by looking at a still from it that, oh, this is going to be a tough one.
It is.
But now you did not see – and also Michelle Williams is – she's getting better and better the more opportunities she has. And
right,
just
that's very true.
Some news about her this week. Her Sundance hit Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling got an NC-17, to which everyone that has seen it completely does not understand why it would get an NC-17. But it did. It's a relationship drama. It's like two characters falling in and out of love. It has barely any nudity in it from what I've heard. It goes to show you that the MPA's mandate about being more concerned with violence and sexuality, so, you know, it's a little hairy. It's not necessarily the case. Yeah. They're so petrified by sexuality.
Sounds incredibly stupid. I'd just release it without a rating, you know, and just leave it at that, you know.
Yeah. Maybe the press that it gets from that might be the best chance it has.
Maybe.
A movie like that, you know. You did not see The Tempest, but what did you hear about it, the new Julie Taymor movie? What was the reaction to people that did see it? Did you hear anything?
Pretty tepid. It was a pretty tepid response from what I heard.
A tepid Tempest?
Yeah. I mean, some of the supporting characters I heard, particularly Germaine Hansu and a little bit of Russell Brand. I heard a little talk about him. But
right.
Generally, it was considered rather campy, and those were generally the kind of the things that we didn't really discuss it very much. I didn't discuss it very much with anybody, except for maybe about two or three people. But that was their general consensus.
Okay, you also saw the new Mike Leigh movie, Another Year, and he churns out a movie, every year or so, and they're always critically acclaimed, and they always pick up Oscar nominations, usually do. What do you think of this one in the scope of his career?
Well, it's a beautiful movie. It's now my second favorite movie of the year. Another Year is kind of a reunion movie in a lot of ways, with a lot of people who have appeared in Mike Leigh movies in the past. I mean, Leslie Manville's been in probably about three or four of them. She's the lead in the movie. And then Jim Broadbent, this is probably his third Mike Leigh movie. And Ruth Sheen is probably at least her third. And then there's a lot of other supporting characters who've also been in Mike Leigh movies before. So it's kind of almost like a Mike Leigh fan movie, if there can be one. it's a great little film about that's split into four parts, and each of the parts follows the relationship between Leslie Manville, who's a very needy alcoholic woman who's having lots of relationship problems and is getting older and is very subconscious about that. And it's about her and her relationship with her best friend and her best friend's husband, played by Ruth Sheen and Jim Broadbent. The first part of the movie takes place at where Ruth and Leslie both work, and then the last three parts take place in different family sort of get-togethers that Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen have, that Leslie Manville comes in and interjects a lot of drama into. Mm-hmm. And it's really a great movie. It's just the kind of movie I love. It's really just a movie about people. It's not really about plot. It's constantly funny, but it's also constantly sad, like almost in the same breath. The acting is unassailable. It's also in widescreen, which is another. I can't remember a Mike Leigh movie that was done in scope either. But it's beautifully shot. It has a really great score. You'd be glad to know that. I think it has a really, really wonderful score. I always like the music in Mike Leigh's movies, but often they're not. Music's not overused in them, and that's a good thing. But in this one, it has a little bit more music than I was used to in a Mike Leigh movie, and I thought it was really beautiful.
Now, you actually got to shake Mike Leigh's hand, didn't you?
I did. I actually got to run out, and he was the only person that I endeavored to meet there at the final press conference. Which, by the way, the movie got the longest ovation of any movie that I saw at the film festival.
Wow!
It got the longest round of applause, and that round of applause extended to them bringing Richard Pena, the executive director, bringing on the five main players of this movie. Manville and Sheen and Broadbent were there. Leigh was there with his producer, and so I just had to make it out there to talk to Mr. Leigh and tell him how much he's meant to me, and I asked him a few questions that were most specifically interesting to me, and he just gave me a good look, and that was it. So it was really nice nice to meet him. I still think that he's the, I really think that he's probably, if not the greatest filmmaker, then at least, well, he's got to be at least probably my favorite filmmaker that's walking the earth right now. I mean, I don't think that anybody has been working in movies for, I guess he's been in movies since 71, if you include all the stuff he did for BBC. And I don't think that there's anybody who's been working in movies for 40 years that has never done a bad thing. I've never seen anything bad by him. So,
yeah. So Michael, another year comes out at the end of the year, not another year, but this year, and we're probably going to have Mike Lee on the show around the time that the film gets released. So the original music in the movie was by a composer named Gary Yershon.
It's a great movie. It's definitely going to get into the Oscar race. And good. Leslie Manville is just unbelievably superb in it. Just outrageously good. It's really ultimately a movie that's really about nurturing and what it takes. It's also a movie that's about friendship, like Social Network is. But this is a movie about friendship in which the question is, how long do you remain friends with someone who's very, very needy before you cut off the friendship and say, you're taking too much from me? You know what I'm saying? So that's really what the movie is about. And
that's really what I'm struggling with you. That's perfect movie. No kidding, it's a joke. All right,
yes.
Tell me about Hereafter, the new Clint Eastwood, Matt Damon, Bryce Dallas Howard, supernatural kind of underpinnings in it. What is that like?
Well, that was a real, real sad down note
to end
the festival on, I'll tell you. But from the very beginning, you know, I started thinking about it. How long has it been since Clint Eastwood has done a movie that was set in Europe? I mean, has it been like since the Iger Sanction or something like that? Like back
probably
that
or Kelly's Heroes, yeah.
So,
but what's the movie about exactly? I mean, it's about that, but what is there the trailer? I don't know. The trailer does not doing it for me.
Well, it's kind of an Inarritu kind of setup. It's three, and you know, it's executive produced by Spielberg and Frank Marshall and Kathleen Kennedy.
Okay.
It's three stories. One takes place in Paris with a female television anchor played by Cécile de France,
mm-hmm.
who gets into the opening scene of the movie is tremendous. She has a near-death experience in the opening scene of the movie. And it's her story about dealing with, you know, her glimpse of, you know, the afterlife or whatever, and trying to find answers to it. And then there's a second story that takes place in London with a set of twins, eight, like 9 or 10 year old boys, and it's about one of those kids dealing with his brother's death and looking to get some kind of quote unquote closure to his brother's death, and then the Matt Damon story, which takes place in San Francisco, is about a gentleman who once had a sort of a thriving business as a psychic and decided to give it up and just decided to live a normal everyman kind of life and
right.
give up his gift. And it's about him being sort of pulled back into it. So those are the three stories. And then, you know, inevitably they have to intertwine. So
what doesn't work about it?
Well, first of all, the reason I asked that question about Clint Eastwood is and whether he's done a movie in Europe for how long has it been? Because the European scenes don't feel quite phony to me, particularly the London scenes. I don't think that it has a real – there's a real sense of place or a real palpable sense of any kind of reality there. So it takes you out of the movie. But, you know, primarily I would say it's the dialogue. I find the dialogue to be quite laughable, even though it's done by Peter Morgan, who did, you know, The Queen and Special Relationship and a few other movies. I could never believe any of it. Also, the movie never, even though it's given this this subject matter, which isn't tackled very often, in this kind of way at least, it never brings up any kind of real issues, you know, like there's a scene where Cécile de France is speaking with her boyfriend in a restaurant or something like that, and they sit down and they have some kind of very tenuous sort of discussion about what happens after you die and everything. But that's about as deep as it gets, really. It doesn't really get into any kind of the religious questions. It kind of fluffs them off to a couple of really dumb little scenes, and then it doesn't lead you anywhere. The movie says that it's about the subject matter, but you know, a movie, but it provokes no thoughts about it, or comes to no conclusions about it, or there's just nothing exciting there, really. I'm being completely frank. In fact, some of it's kind of laughable. There's a scene in it, and this is where Bryce Dallas Howard comes in. There's a few lively scenes that take place at a, I guess the Bryce Dallas Howard and Matt Damon characters meet at an adult education class for cooking, and the instructor, they got, you know who Stephen Sharippa is? They got Stephen Sharippa to play the instructor of the cooking class. So he's there. He looks all huge with his big, huge chef outfit on. And immediately the audience started laughing. Every time he was on, even though he wasn't really specifically doing anything funny, every time he was on, it was just funny. And that became the most memorable scenes in the movie, is the scenes with Stephen Sharippa, because it was the only scene that moved you to any kind of feeling whatsoever. You know, it didn't. There wasn't. It's just a big sort of zero, to tell you the truth. It's too bad. But
It begins with a bang and ends with a whimper.
The ending is really bad. But
opening is like a big CGI piece, which is unusual for Eastwood, right?
It is. It's a big CGI. Tsunami, and it's quite good. It's not just, and the effects are well used too. I would say this though: why did they feel the need to have they do CGI of the afterlife too? You know, and I remember a movie back in 1980, which I compared this movie to quite heavily, called Resurrection.
Oh, great movie.
And that's a really good movie, right? Ellen Burstyn is a woman who has a near-death experience and finds out that she can heal people now. That movie had a lot more interesting things to say about this subject matter in every way, shape, or form. You know, it had more dramatic things to say, funnier things to say. You know, it all felt more real. And if you were considering going to see this movie, I'd say just go and get Resurrection instead, because that's a movie that really deserves.
I would say the three best movies ever made about psychics and that kind of thing are Resurrection, The Dead Zone, and Vibes with Cyndi Lauper.
Vibes. No, but The Dead Zone.
Oh my God.
I always forget about The Dead Zone, but that is one of the best. And the Ellen Burstyn one's very good, too. I would need
it's
to watch it again.
It's Ellen Burstyn's favorite movie, if I remember.
Yeah, that would be a long time since I've seen that. But
I really love that movie. But remember in Resurrection, they have the afterlife, and it's just a bunch of people with lots of light and smoke around them and stuff? Here they do it all CGI, and I'm like, why do that when you can do the other?
The movie with a power of its convictions. I mean, it goes all the way with it, which is that Mimi Rogers movie from Michael.
Oh yeah, that was incredible.
What was that?
The Rapture, right?
The
yes.
Rapture, right?
Oh yeah, the Rapture is beyond that. I mean, it's beyond all of these. That's quite a.
You think that they'll cop out at the end and not show what they've been discussing the whole time?
They show.
Yeah.
They show it big time. Great movie.
They do.
Fantastic film.
That's one of my favorite movies of the 90s.
Michael Tolkien, that's his name.
Yeah, Michael Tolkien, who wrote The Player, yeah.
Yeah. Has he done anything else since then, by the way?
Well, he did a movie with Peter Weller, The New Age, that's excellent. And I think he might have done one other. He directed one other. And I think he and the guy, Bruce Joel Rubin, didn't they write the script for Deep Impact?
Yeah, they might have.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, now that you mention it. So, yeah,
a film that does not have its title.
No, it doesn't.
All right, so, okay, we got 10 minutes. Tell me what else you got.
Let's see. Some other things I would keep an eye out for. The first 2 weeks, I forgot to mention this last week, I saw... also Certified Copy with Juliette Binoche. She won the Best Actress Award at Cannes this year, and it's Abbas Kiarostami's first film outside of Iran. And it takes place in Paris, and she's a shop owner who goes to a reading by one of her favorite authors, and then endeavors to meet the author afterwards, and then I won't give anything away, but the movie gets into some very weird territory, some very Edward Albee, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf kind of territory after that. Hmm. And it's in a lot of ways it resembles a very twisted version of Before Sunset, the Richard Linklater movie. In the sense that it's really just basically about her and the gentleman whose name escapes me right now, who plays the male in the movie, who's British, by the way, is a British opera star, and he's apparently okay in the movie, but he's overmatched by Juliette Binoche, which I think is one of the movie's main detriments.
It would have been better if that part had been played by Gerard Depardieu. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe. There might have been some sparks there. Maybe he got turned down for it or something. But the movie's in. You get to see Juliette Binoche speaking English, French, and she does some killer Italian in the movie too. So, and hers is a really magnificent performance. So I would look out for that. There's a documentary by probably the greatest documentarian living right now, Frederick Wiseman, who's been working for years investigating many different aspects of society. He's done like state legislature and public housing and missile about the missile silos, or he did a movie called Titicut Follies, which is probably his most famous film, about looking at how the mentally ill are treated in a upstate New York hospital. And this is in the mid-60s. So anyway, his movie is called Boxing Gym, and it takes place at an Austin boxing gym. And it's just about the characters there, and it's quite great. It's got a lot of movement in it. It's funny. It's real. It's the kind of documentary you don't see very much these days because it's completely verite. No narrator. No talking head interviews. Just what's really happening at the gym. And it's a great boxing movie too. I mean, it has to rank up there with one of the best boxing movies, because it really gives you some tips.
So it's the Raging Bull of documentaries.
In a way.
Yeah, you know you're going to see that quote on a poster.
You're right, but hopefully I don't want it attributed to me. Let's see, what else? I got another movie, too. One more movie. I've got, I saw a Romanian film called Aurora, which is by the guy who made, a few years ago, he made a movie called The Death of Dr. Death of Mr. Lazarescu, which is about an old guy. Have you guys seen that?
Yes, I have seen Death of Mr.
Yeah. So it's by that same filmmaker. It's a very different subject matter. Again, it's best for me not to give too much away about it, but it's 3 hours long, like Lazarescu.
Oh, God.
And it has even less dialogue in it than that movie did. So, I mean, it's got – but that said, it's incredibly riveting. The director actually plays the lead in the movie, and he plays this gentleman who we can't figure out, is he married, is he not married? We can't figure out what his place in the world is. We can't even figure out – you know, where exactly he's living. You know, it takes a little while to figure all these things out. You know, he's very suspicious, very paranoid kind of person, can't make a move without checking out every other possible move that he can make or whatever. And you slowly, slowly, as the movie goes along, you figure out what his game really is. I don't want to give anything else away, but it's actually quite suspenseful and an unusual lead performance by Christy Pugh, I think it was, I can't say his last name, but it's a really terrific movie too. Might be a difficult movie to find playing at your local theater one of these days, but certainly something to look for on DVD.
So
for sure.
So what's it called? What's it called again?
It's called Aurora. A-U-R-O-R-A, and it's quite great. I was really, really amazed by it. Saw a few films that I didn't really care for at all, too, like Manuel de Oliveira's, who's 104 years old. He's the oldest living filmmaker. He's Spanish, I think, and he released his new movie at the film festival called The Strange Case of Angelica, and it was the first movie of his that I've ever seen, even though he's been working in the movies since the 30s. And unfortunately, I didn't really care for it. But apparently, this was a movie that he had abandoned in the 50s and has resurrected. And so I thought, oh well, maybe that's the reason I don't like it. So I need to check out more of his movies. But generally, the film festival was great. I mean, it was just a kind of an embarrassment of riches. But you have to be ready to be patient with a lot of them. That's what I'd say. But it was a great festival, and I think that another year was probably the best thing that I saw. But I have to say that you know, Social Network and Uncle Boone from All His Past Lives from Thailand are really right behind it. You know.
Okay. So what is the next big event there in New York?
Oh, I don't know, actually. What is the next big event? I think that there is something. The Gotham International Film Festival, I think, is starting around, I think, next week.
Okay.
And then we'll see what else happens. Tribeca won't happen until
May.
Spring.
Right.
Yeah.
So
okay,
maybe late April or early May.
We thank you very much for covering
you,
the film festival for us.
Absolutely, absolutely. And,
you can read coverage on your blog, right?
Yeah, you can read coverage at filmicability.blogspot.com. That's filmicability, I-C, ability. And then, I'm still writing up a lot of stuff, so it's still appearing.
Okay.
All right, great. Thank you, Dean.
All right, guys. So I'll talk to you later on this week. Now
thank
you,
buddy.
Thank you.
Just get back and to calling in and shooting the shit with you guys.
That'll be nice. Thank you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you later.
Bye bye. All right. That's Dean with our New York Film Festival recap. Good coverage. Thank you very much for that, Dean. Okay. You know that Polanski's cast his next movie, God of Carnage.
Oh wow. Okay.
Jodie Foster's in it. I don't have the rest of the cast in front of me, but I know that Jodie Foster's in it. It's like four lead characters. So I'm just curious why you didn't go with the Broadway cast of Jeff Daniels and Marcia Gay Harden and James Gandolfini and Hope Davis. I mean, he recast all four of those roles that they made famous in the Broadway run of the show.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he makes his own choices, so hopefully he'll come on the show and tell us about it sometime. That would be great.
That would be.
Stanley Kubrick thinks that Dean is a star. He says, thank you, Dean. So yes, we all thank him for that.
Yeah,
all
we
right,
do.
Let's end tonight's show. Wednesday night, name that film score. Next Sunday night, I think Peter Mayhew, who immortalized Chewbacca in all the Star Wars movies, I think we're going to run that interview on Sunday night. Frank Whaley next week, great actor. And then the horror series coming up, Galen Hurd and several high-profile guests coming up. And then stay tuned for more details about our Kubrick series because all the guests are starting to come in for that one too.
That is true, yes.
All right, Jerry.
All right,
thank you,
buddy. Great show. Thank you, Dean. Thank you, everyone. And we will see you again on Wednesday night.
All righty. Here we close out with Alexander Desplat's Tamara Drew score. Go see it. It's in theaters right now. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.